So with those very brief technical reminders, I think we're ready to get started. So at this point, I'll ask our support staff to pull up the presentation materials so they can take over screen sharing. And I'm going to turn the floor to our very first speaker today. Alexis, I can see that you are on camera, so I'm going to replace my face with your face, and I will let you unmute and take the floor from here.
All right. Thank you, Jean. Thanks so much. And welcome, everyone, to today's webinar. I see that we have about 160 or so folks on the line, and we are so appreciative that all of you took the time to join us today. My name is Alexis Rourke-Reyes, as you can see on the screen there. I work at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and I manage the Superfund redevelopment program, so that we're going to hear about today. But there are a lot of people at EPA involved in this program, and we're happy to introduce you to a few. Also, some of our external partners that are going to talk with us later today. So we hope that whether you're a prospective purchaser, a state and local government partner, or EPA site team member that's charged with managing the robust cleanup or community involvement processes that Superfund uses, that you'll get some useful info and insights from those that have done this work out there in the real world. So with that, let's turn to the next slide, please. Thanks, Lauren. Okay, so I will kick us off with a brief overview to the Superfund redevelopment program. And then our speakers are going to discuss the top 10 questions to ask when buying a Superfund site. And there's a fact sheet that accompanies that, as well as our web pages, and also a new fact sheet on a service that has been around for some time, but the Prospective Purchaser Inquiry Service. After that, we've invited two of our developers, partners that we've worked with in the past and that have been involved in Superfund sites, Annika Colston from AC Power LLC and Michael Goldstein of Goldstein Environmental Law Firm and Goldstein Kite Environmental. And then I'll do a short wrap up. We'll have time for questions at the end of the presentation. They have a lot to tell you, so I will try to be brief on this introductory part and make sure that we get some time to answer your questions. So feel free, as Jean said, to enter your questions as in the chat box as they come, or in the Q&A box, I'm sorry, as they come to your mind, so that way they can kind of queue them up for everyone. Okay, the next slide, please. Thank you. Okay, so just as a kind of a overview for everybody, depending on, you know, folks that might be newer to Superfund, we like to think about at EPA, all the contaminated properties that are out there is kind of a solar system. And so there are different kinds. They are addressed by different regulations and different parts of EPA and programs. We're here to talk today about Superfund sites, which you see are designated as a planet Earth there in that kind of scale that we have. But just to introduce you to a couple of the other kinds of sites we have in our country, estimated around 450,000 to 600,000 brownfields, which are kind of a more kind of uncharacterized contaminated property. And then we have a bit underground storage tanks, the abandoned ones that have been left from previous industrial uses, around 200,000 in our country. And then of that, we have 40,000 Superfund sites, and that includes both sites that are remedial, that are included on our national priorities list, and removal sites, which are usually happen on a shorter timeline. And then we also have 6,400 RCRA sites. If you're ever interested in looking at the locations of most of these sites, there's a good resource that EPA has, Cleanups in My Community, and you can kind of get a sense of what's out there and what's in your community. And in terms of Superfund, just wanted to highlight for everyone just a little bit of basics about the program, because it is a unique program and there are the kind of unique considerations that we're going to be talking about later. So just wanted to give everyone that orientation. EPA's Superfund program is responsible for cleaning up some of the nation's most contaminated land and responding to environmental emergencies and natural disasters. And so that's also covered in that removal action that I talked about. But what is a Superfund site? Why does it get that designation? That really comes from a piece of legislation called the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation and Liability Act. So CERCLA, you've probably heard it. It was established in 1980, and that authorizes EPA to clean up contaminated sites and requires the parties that are responsible for contamination to either perform the cleanups or reimburse the government for EPA cleanup. EPA-led work. Though determining liability is not always easy, we have one of our attorneys here that you'll be hearing from a little bit later, and we can attest to that. So in order to address the cases where a responsible party cannot be identified or could not cover the costs of the cleanup, Congress has established a trust fund that is now around $8.5 billion. And that's what that trust fund is kind of what we refer to as the super fund. And so just with that kind of quick background, we can move on to the next slide and just talk a little bit about the program. Thank you. So one thing that we're really fortunate to have to support the cleanup and also integration of these sites back into kind of productive use is the Superfund Redevelopment Program. And so that program is really initially designed to support EPA staff as they work with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities and integrating reuse options that are appropriate into the cleanup process. So starting early in that process, not waiting just until the site is ready to go and ready to clean up. We really encourage site teams in particular to be talking about reuse as early as possible. And so there are so many great examples. You can see some of them pictured here of Superfund site reuse all over the country. It is an amazing process and set of projects and can result in jobs and has resulted in jobs, housing, new businesses, municipal facilities, recreation resources for communities, wildlife habitat. And there's so many different ways to reuse Superfund sites. So for those of you that are work in the program, you know that no site is the same. And so there's also no one size fit all solution to determining what reuse type will be most appropriate. So it's really an opportunity to be creative, which I think you'll hear more about later. And I think that's one of the things that makes it really exciting. So while EPA doesn't own the sites or control local land use, this work is also an important part of our mission. And it's important for the communities that we serve. We want to return these sites back to beneficial community use in a manner that is also protective of the remedy. All that investment that went into cleaning up the site, that's, you know, first and foremost, keeping human health and keeping people safe in their communities. But we do have, as I said, a wide array of tools, resources, and supports for tribes, local governments, communities, and developers to use on these sites. You're going to hear about some of them today, and we'll encourage you to take a look on our web pages as well. And just, you know, learn and read and see that the case studies that are there and kind of the demonstrated stories, that the reuse possibilities are really endless. So next slide, please. And we cannot leave without kind of sharing some of our exciting return on investment information that we have. So, you know, above all, we're EPA. Our mission is to protect public health and the environment. And so in terms of environmental returns, I think probably many of the folks on the line here know that reusing brownfields is a really important contribution to preserving greenfields. So it's estimated that for every acre of brownfields, you know, including Superfund sites or other contaminated sites that are redeveloped or reused, you can protect 4.5 acres of greenfields. So it has really important ecological benefits as well. It also, again, as I mentioned, ensures the long-term protectiveness of the remedy. And it's an opportunity to promote sustainable development and for an EPA to collaborate with other offices and, you know, other external partners that are interested in green infrastructure, promoting resiliency, developing alternative or renewable energy resources for communities as well. In terms of economics, we're also really lucky that we get to develop both the regional and national levels economic statistics on how these cleanup dollars are really transformed into sales, into property tax, into, you know, value on the ground. And so we have some great resources that we encourage you to take a look at our website. And then also social equity. I mentioned the community involvement process earlier, and that is another amazing thing I think about the CERCLA regulation, that we really have a prescribed community involvement standard, and that requires communities to have a voice in decisions. It gives us an opportunity to address issues in communities that have been historically underserved or that might have environmental justice concerns. Clearly having a Superfund site in your community could indicate that potentially. And so it's it really helps us kind of check a lot of the boxes that are really important to us in terms of our values. Next slide, please. Okay, so now we're going to get down to the concrete, the how to do it. Here's some of the top questions that get asked and that you should be asking if you're thinking about buying a Superfund site, or if you're on a site team, that you should want to have the answers to kind of at the ready if you get questions like this. I'm going to introduce a couple of my colleagues at EPA that are going to take us through this next section. First, Bill Denman. Bill Denman is currently the Chief of Site Assessment and the Remedy Decisions Branch at headquarters in EPA in our Superfund program. But for many years, Bill worked in EPA's Southeast region, which is Region 4, based in Atlanta, Georgia, managing the cleanup of Superfund sites and working with teams and communities to help Superfund sites back to beneficial use after cleanup. So he was one of the original authors of this fact sheet and this service that we're going to talk about today. So lucky to get to hear from him directly. We also have Matt Sander, who is also an EPA headquarters. He's a cleanup enforcement attorney. Attorney, and he provides policy and case specific support to our program. And then we also have Casey Luckett Snyder, and she's from EPA's Region 6, which covers Texas, New Mexico, Louisiana, Arkansas, and Oklahoma, as well as 66 tribal nations. And she's a lot of experience working with communities and putting Superfund sites back to beneficial reuse. So I think with that, I will turn it over to Bill to take us through our first questions.
Great. Well, thank you, Alexis, and thanks for the introduction. I really appreciate that. And as Alexis said, I was there when we created this fact sheet. And a little bit of the history is, as she said, I was the redevelopment coordinator in our Region 4 office in the Southeast. And you know, as we all know, in 2002, the Brownfield Amendments were passed and introduced the concept of bona fide prospective purchaser, and the fact that developers could now purchase property knowing that there was contamination present at the site and not be liable as a potentially responsible party or have a defense to that liability. And so we started to see a real uptick in the amount of interest that people had in redeveloping the Superfund sites. And so at the time I was working with an attorney there, her name is Kat West. If you guys have ever seen any past training classes that I've done, a lot of times Kat and I did them jointly. And I was in her office one day and I said, you know, we were talking and we said, gosh, we're getting a lot of the same questions over and over again. We should do something to try to, you know, preemptively answer some of these, or, you know, they're probably questions that are never getting to us. And people are leaving, you know, before they know the answer to this. And, you know, they, depending on who they call at EPA, they may get different answers. So I had been up late the night before and I'd seen David Letterman. And I said, you know what, David Letterman did a top 10 list last night. And wouldn't it be funny if we did like a top 10 questions to ask when buying a Superfund site tech fact sheet? And she said, that's a fantastic idea. And so she reached in her desk, she pulled out her legal pad that she had nearby, and we started writing questions and started saying, okay, let's just, you know, brainstorm what kind of questions are we getting? What would people want to know? And the first one, you know, was, why would somebody be interested in a Superfund site? You know, why would anybody want to purchase a Superfund site? And of course, as you know, we all know, any of us who deal in or dealt with real estate at all, there's only three things that matter, and that's location, location, and location, right? And so in my experience, dealing with the redevelopment of sites, it's really the location and the characteristics of a piece of property that determine, you know, who's interested in it and how much interest there's in. And so, you know, that's certainly an advantage, you know, because, you know, a lot of the Superfund sites are in really good locations. It's why they were used in the past and why, you know, they are either, you know, nearby, you know, transportation corridors, you know, roads, railroads, you know, rivers, things like that, or, you know, they have a particular characteristic. They're maybe near a connection to the grid or something like that that would make them attractive for different types of redevelopment. And so, you know, that was one of the first questions that we wrote out. And so the second, you know, question that we came up, you know, with is, well, you know, if somebody was interested, how would they get information about a Superfund site? And so for those of you on the call in this training, if you're new to this, The most important thing to know is who the Superfund redevelopment coordinator is in a region, and we'll have that information later in the presentation. You can find it online as well. That person, a lot of times, is a project manager, like I was, like Casey is, who you'll hear from in just a minute, in their region. And so they work on sites as well, but they're also kind of the internal consultant, if you will, for redevelopment issues. And they can answer a lot of questions, put you in touch with the right people, facilitate calls or meetings to talk about things and get some of these issues resolved. And so, the third question that I'm going to talk about today is, does the property have any restrictions or can it be reused safely? And so when we were coming up with these questions, we thought, well, people have questions, and then people may have questions that they don't know they should ask. And so these are the kind of things that we wanted to put out there and say, yeah, if you don't have this question yet, you're going to have it at some point in the future. And of course, does the property have any restrictions and can it be reused safely? Two very important parts of a question, so that's really what somebody's looking at as far as whether they can use it. And we have a great example. We were having a call one time with someone who wanted to use a piece of property for a nursery. And, it was an old abandoned building, had a big parking lot. And so we talked to them a little bit. Oh, how do you operate, your nursery? Well, I grow plants in pots. And, when they get a certain size, I sell them. And we said, oh, that's great. There's a big parking lot there. And, it's in a good location for you. You're interested in doing this. And so somebody asked, well, how do you water the plants? And they said, well, we sink a well and we use that water for irrigation. And we said, oh, that's going to be a problem here because the groundwater is the primary area that we're focusing on. It's a big groundwater cleanup site, and a lot of contamination. And so until that contamination is cleaned up, which is going to be probably decades, you're not going to be able to use the groundwater. And so they said, oh, well, that's really important to us. If we have to pay for municipal water, it just doesn't work out for us. And you saved us a lot of time pursuing this. And, they moved on to another piece of property. And really, we viewed that as a success because we were able to communicate with them, the kind of restrictions that may be at a site. Sites may be, limited to commercial industrial use, or they may be certain other restrictions or areas that you can build on, or you could only build a certain size building on, or, things like that. And so that's an important question, is to know, how the property can be used in a way that doesn't interfere with EPA's cleanup. And of course, that's very important for us as well as a new owner. And so, we really went through a lot of these questions and tried to provide some good answers and direct them to resources. And as we were using this fact sheet or these questions to hand out to people, my colleague Matt Sander, who's going to join just after this to talk about him, is in headquarters was at the time. And he said, this would be really interesting and useful on a national level. Let's see if we can issue this as a national fact sheet that people can use. And so Matt was kind enough to take it into headquarters and work it through to be jointly issued by the EPA Superfund program as well as the enforcement group. And so it was agreed upon, by the by the programmatic folks, like in the area that I work in, but also by our enforcement program, to say these are defenses to liability and ways that sites can be put into productive use in a constructive way that's consistent with the law and doesn't can in ways that people can limit their liability as a responsible party. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Matt Sander, who like me has had a lot of experience with redevelopment and particularly this fact sheet and its development. And now it's great to see it in its updated and second iteration. So with that, Matt, I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks, Bill, and hello, everyone. I am really happy you're here, and I'm happy to be here. So what you see here is really a critical question every interested party, and especially a purchaser, should ask before they buy a Superfund site. And that is, how can I get protection from Superfund liability if I buy or lease a contaminated property? This is number 4 in our fact sheet, and it's extremely important. Most people don't understand that potential Superfund liability risks, and they need information about how to obtain liability protection. The great news is that a purchaser or a lessee will not be responsible for cleanup costs at a Superfund site for contamination they did not cause, but only if they achieve a liability protection. The top 10 fact sheet explains this and focuses on the most common liability protection, which is the Superfund Law's bona fide prospective purchaser, or BFPP defense. The BFPP defense is a self-implementing liability protection. And the fact sheet is going to explain how parties can go through a number of steps, beginning with what we call the all-appropriate inquiry process, or AAI, you may have heard of, which is a due diligence process that's required as part of a BFPP's responsibility to achieve and establish their BFPP status. Moving on, top 10 question number 5 is, would I be responsible for doing any cleanup if I purchase or lease a property at a Superfund site? This is a question that, again, like cleanup costs, this is a question most prospective purchasers are going to want to know up front. Not only do they have to pay for cleanup costs? They want to know if they have to perform the cleanup. And the fact sheet explains that generally a property owner or lessee who's achieved BFPP status or some other federal liability protection, that they're not going to be responsible for ongoing or future cleanup work. However, there's a catch. To maintain their liability protection, a property owner or a lessee, they have to protect the cleanup work that's been done at the site, and they have to prevent or limit the spread of any contamination from the site. So, for example, BFPP is required to exercise appropriate care by taking reasonable steps to stop any continuing releases and to prevent any threatened future releases. So while, you know, each site is unique and has unique circumstances to deal with, the fact sheet does provide some general examples of what these reasonable steps may include. For example, it could include preventing public exposure by restricting property access. It could include maintaining the cleanup work that's been done to date and preventing the site conditions from getting worse. It could be assessing and limiting the spread of newly discovered contamination, or monitoring a lessee's conduct and addressing any improper practices. But the bottom line is that a purchaser, while there are some affirmative obligations they have to do to be responsible environmental stewards, their obligations are not the same of what a potentially responsible party who is liable for the contamination. They're going to have a different set of responsibilities that are going to be more about what's about being a good environmental steward versus stepping into the shoes of a liable party. But speaking of, cleanup work, a prospective purchaser can request to conduct part of the cleanup under EPA's oversight. And this is going to lead me to our next question. Next slide, please. Where do I do that? Oh, there you are. Thank you. So question number 6 is, are there benefits to voluntarily agreeing to do some of the cleanup work at a site? And the top 10 fact sheet acknowledges this, and it's goal is to inform interested parties that generally EPA is supportive of purchasers and lessees doing cleanup work in many circumstances. And this is we support this for a number of reasons. This kind of work can accelerate a cleanup. It can help enable the property to achieve its what we call reasonably anticipated future land use. It can facilitate the long-term stewardship of the property, certainly conserve federal resources if there's no responsible party who's of financial means to clean up the site. And having purchasers do the work at the site if they want to, can also support community goals. So we will work with a party who wants to do this kind of work. The key is to remember that any work that's going to be done by a purchaser needs to be done under EPA oversight and is subject to EPA approval. And this is all, on a site-by-site basis. So not every site's going to be the right fit for this kind of idea. But generally, we'd love to talk to purchasers who want to do work at Superfund sites. So moving along to question number 7, how can EPA liens impact a purchase of a Superfund site property? And this is a really important question because there are two types of liens that are used under CERCLA. One's called a Superfund lien, and the other's called a windfall lien. The top 10 fact sheet recommends that interested parties begin discussions with EPA as early as possible to make sure they understand these liens or potential liens. And to ensure, this can help prevent any delays if they're, really serious about acquiring a property. Good news is, depending on the situation, EPA may be able to release or settle the liens before or concurrently with a property acquisition and transfer of a title. My last question that I'll cover is number 8, and that is, what information does a lender need and how can EPA help? The great news is that the Superfund law includes liability protections specifically for secured creditors, such as lenders, that don't participate in the management of the property, but are simply holding a security interest in it. The top 10 fact sheet outlines EPA's willingness to work with purchasers and lenders and to use site-specific tools. These tools can help address a lender's potential concerns about financing the purchase of a contaminated property. Typically, the kind of tool I'm talking about would be a comfort status letter from the agency, and we'll talk about those a little bit more later in the resources section. The fact sheet, it includes a link to the Superfund program, enforcement programs, policy and guidance documents database, which includes a number of really key guidance documents you or your counsel should be aware of before pursuing the purchase of a contaminated property. And that includes documents that address the lender liability protections that are available at Superfund sites. So with that, thank you all. And I'm going to hand it over to my colleague, Casey Luckett-Snyder, for questions number 9 and 10. Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. First of all, I want to say welcome to everybody. We are all excited to have you join us. We're especially excited to hear from some of our partners who have actually done this redevelopment work here in a few minutes. Thank you for your interest in beneficially reusing and redeveloping Superfund sites. I will say those of us at EPA who work on promoting and facilitating the beneficial future use of our Superfund sites, we are fully and wholly committed to it. It's not just something we think is a good idea. It is critical to the work that we do at EPA. So I want to thank you for your interest. And I am going to close out the top 10 questions to ask when buying a Superfund site. And then I'm going to launch into a couple of the resources that we have that you all might find helpful. If you're working on an EPA site team, we hope that you will become familiar with the resources we have to promote future use, beneficial future use. And if you are interested, if you're external to EPA and you are interested in Superfund site redevelopment, these resources will be key for you. So, but before we get to that, let's cover the last two questions in the top 10 questions to ask when buying a Superfund site, or sites if you want to buy more than one. Number nine, how can local governments assist in getting Superfund sites back into reuse? You know, the bottom line is local government support for a specific beneficial reuse of a Superfund site is critical. It is really important that that the local government be involved in the reuse discussion, and we certainly promote that early and often at EPA. As a site project manager, we work closely with our local governments throughout the cleanup process, throughout the discussion about future use at sites. And then we also work closely with our local governments so that they understand that there's actually special Superfund liability protections. Matt has covered some of those here over the last few slides, but there are actually special Superfund liability protections that can apply to local governments. And we are we work very closely with them so that they understand what those protections are and how they might apply, because we often find in the Superfund redevelopment world that it's the local government who's going to acquire a property kind of in between the current property owner, or maybe it's the responsible party, maybe it's somebody else. They're going to kind of, the local government's going to step in, they're going to acquire that property, and they're going to steward and shepherd forward the reuse. They may not be the final property owner, but they do play a key role typically in getting that site into reuse. And sometimes property acquisition is a part of that role. So if you are a local government and you're listening in, I certainly would encourage you to talk to your EPA site teams and your Superfund redevelopment coordinator. There's one in each EPA region. I'm in the Dallas office in the Region 6, kind of south central part of the country. So it's critical that we get you the information that was most helpful for you as you're deciding about your role as a local government in promoting and moving sites forward into beneficial use. The last question we have in the top 10 is kind of a catch-all, and I'm excited to be able to do it because I'm getting to talk about all the resources that I use as a Superfund redevelopment coordinator and to help, again, promote and facilitate the beneficial reuse of Superfund sites. So what support can EPA provide to help purchasers and lessees? I'm glad you asked. Next slide, please. So these are some of our most popular and useful support tools that we have. We have so much to offer in the Superfund redevelopment program. And these are some of the things that we do most often. You heard Matt mention comfort letters earlier. Those are very common in the Superfund world and in the Superfund reuse world, where a site team gets together with the site attorney, the project manager, the Superfund redevelopment coordinator, and we issue comfort letters to kind of answer a number of questions about a site. Alexis, a few minutes ago, talked about the website, and I see that there is a link to the Superfund redevelopment website in the chat. I would really encourage you to explore it if you have some time. We have all kinds of guidance on there, handbooks, fact sheets. This fact sheet that we're talking about today is one of those. And it really starts that conversation, and it starts lots of folks thinking about what do we need to do if we are interested in even considering a future land use for a Superfund site in our community. PPI service. PPI is the Prospective Purchaser Inquiry Service that we've developed in the Superfund Redevelopment Program. I'm going to talk specifically about that here in a second, but it's a service that we offer to make sure that folks who are interested in purchasing a property that's located within a Superfund site, that they have the information they need to make a decision about that and whether or not they want to move forward. Liability protection, something else that we talk about a lot in the Superfund Redevelopment Program. We have close partnerships with our Superfund site attorneys and with our attorneys in headquarters. You just heard from Matt. We talk a lot about liability protections, about the bona fide prospective purchaser liability protection, and how that can apply for folks who are interested in purchasing a Superfund site. We want to make sure that nobody gets caught up in the Superfund liability chain. And so we spend a lot of time talking about liability protections and what a prospective purchaser needs to do to avail themselves of those liability protections. We have a very new tool that is so exciting. And if you have a minute, I would encourage you to take a look at it and maybe just explore the area where you are. It's the Superfund Redevelopment Mapper. We now have this mapping tool available, and it maps all the Superfund sites across the country. So, you know, type in your city, and we have created a polygon layer so that we can identify the aerial extent of all the Superfund sites across the country. And then on top of that, there is numerous most data layers available, both built in, and then you can add your own data layers to the mapper so that you can utilize it to look at all kinds of attributes and characteristics of the area and the land surrounding Superfund sites. So that, again, as you are exploring the potential for redevelopment, if you need to know more about the community, if you need to know more about the economics, what kind of floodplain is it in? I mean, you name it. This mapper will help you. This mapper will help you be able to hone in on that to the specific area in and around the Superfund sites. So it's a cool tool, and I encourage you to explore it. We have lots of technical assistance that we offer to communities, reuse planning, reuse assessments. We do work with communities, with local governments, with EPA site teams looking at institutional controls and how those will fit into the remedy that we're selecting. We do all kinds of things in the Superfund redevelopment program, and I'm always excited to talk about the opportunities that we have to provide our Superfund site partners and stakeholders in exploring future use opportunities. I did want to talk just a brief second about the PPI service. I think it's one of the most important tools we offer in the redevelopment program. So next slide. So this is we've kind of made it more formal now. And Bill Denman, who spoke earlier, was the originator of this prospective purchaser inquiry service. We've now put it together and put it down on paper in an effect sheet. And we're trying to do it very consistently across the country, all the Superfund redevelopment coordinators. And the purpose of this is so that we are getting the information, site-specific information, out to a prospective purchaser before they purchase the property. And as Bill, he gave the example of the nursery and the conversation they had, and it sounded good. And then they said, oh, and we're going to need to use the groundwater. Okay, maybe it doesn't sound so good. That's the key. Is the goal for EPA is to answer questions about the site so that whoever's the prospective purchaser and who has an interest in purchasing the site is really making an informed business decision. And again, we really understand that real estate transactions happen and on a different timeline than the work we typically do here at EPA, particularly in the Superfund program. And so even more so than just getting the information, we want to get it to a prospective purchaser in a timely manner, right? We know that's important as you all are considering purchasing and moving forward with contracts and the transaction. So these are basically the overview of what we offer in the service. It can take the form of a meeting, in-person meeting. It takes the form of it used to be a phone call. Now it's like a virtual meeting, right? Everybody's doing Zoom and Teams. So, but we get the site team together. So we'd really like to have the Superfund redevelopment coordinator on this call. We'd like to have the site project manager. We'd like to have the site attorney, and we'd like to have the community involvement coordinator so that we can get all of these questions answered for the prospective purchaser, again, with the goal of getting them the information that they need. We talk about the site. What is the status? Where are we in the Superfund process? If you're familiar with Superfund, you know that there are several phases in the process, and it goes from essentially the remedial investigation, where we're still trying to characterize and figure out what's going on at the site, all the way to operation and the maintenance. We've done the cleanup, and the site is in the operation and maintenance phase. There's typically a lot of years in between those ends of the Superfund process. And so we want to make sure that a prospective purchaser knows where that site is, because their potential use of the property can certainly be impacted by the work that EPA and or a responsible party may be needing to do on the site. And then we talk about the compatibility of the proposed reuse, right? That's the most important thing. What do you want to do with the property? What do you vision for it? And is that compatible with either the remedy we've already implemented, or can we fit that into the remedy that we are considering as we move forward? What are the available Superfund CERCLA liability protections? Again, spend a lot of time talking about that. It's very important that prospective purchasers are aware of those and that they take the steps necessary to avail themselves of those liability protections. Liens, we talked about that. That's an important topic, and it got its own question in the Superfund top 10 questions to ask when buying a Superfund site. So we want to address that with any prospective purchasers. And then we start talking about what are the tools and support that we can offer through EPA to help that purchaser move a site from, you know, purchasing it into redevelopment. And so it's an exciting service to be a part of. It's successful either way. As Bill mentioned in his example of the nursery, it's a very sign of a very successful meeting with a prospective purchaser when they can make that informed business decision. So it's always something that we encourage folks to reach out to EPA, the EPA site team, and the Superfund redevelopment coordinator often and early so that we can have these conversations again before a purchaser buys a property and then kind of gets caught off guard about what they actually bought. So with that, I am going to turn it back over to Alexis and Jean.
All right. Thank you, Casey. And that was a lot of information. So we're going to stop for a quick poll, quick knowledge check. But thank you so much, Bill, Matt, and Casey. Jean, go ahead.
All right. Thank you. So I'm about to launch a pop-up poll that a new window will now appear on your screen. We're going to pose a question to all of you. This first question asks, generally speaking, Superfund sites can be reused at what stage of the cleanup process? You'll see four options to select. You can pick A, pre-ROD, B, post-ROD, and ROD stands for Record of Decision. I apologize, that was not spelled out, but that's what that acronym stands for. C, option post-construction completion, or D, anytime. Now, you'll simply click the circle to the left of the answer that you think is correct, and then hit the submit button on that poll window. If you happen to be on a mobile device, sometimes these polls don't immediately pop up. You'll need to look for three dots or a little menu drop down that says more. And from there, you can click and manually launch the polls. If for any reason you're having problems with these polls, remember, you can always type your answer into the Q&A. That will still count. There is no penalty for a wrong answer. We're just trying to make sure that the information is relaying and the presenters are double checking what you've picked up so far in the presentation. It does look like about two-thirds of you have voted, so I'll give you all just a few more seconds. Again, we'll close this poll out here in just a moment, and then we'll talk through those responses. All right, we've gotten to about three-quarters of you having cast your votes, so I'm going to close that poll on 3, 2, 1, and let's share those results. So it looks like about half of the audience selected D, anytime. But the other half were really torn between post-ROD or post-construction completion. So Alexis, what answer were we looking for here?
Actually, anytime. So generally speaking, I'm really glad that we did this question so we could have the chance to kind of reinforce, because it's important for no matter what your role is that you're here with. I think it's as long as the reuse is compatible with cleanup and existing or future site restrictions, Superfunds can be reused at any stage. We have a lot of examples of sites that are not fully construction complete, but are being, you know, safely reused, productively reused. As you know, Casey and others were mentioning, the sooner that EPA knows about that proposed reuse of the property, the better. Because sometimes, depending on maybe if you are pre-record of decision, pre-ROD, you may be able to incorporate some of that intended use into something called the reasonably anticipated future land use as a portion of that decision document. And also maybe there are cost-effective synergies between reuse and cleanup. So early, anytime is good. Early is even better. With that, we'll probably move on. But I'm glad that we asked that one. Thanks, Jean.
All right, excellent. And just very quickly, I do see a number of questions are coming into that Q&A window. So I just wanted to let you all know we see them. These are great questions. We will absolutely start addressing those later when we have our open Q&A period. For those of you that might be raising your hand, remember, we're going to hold off and we're going to start with electronic questions. So if you have a question or a comment, please use that Q&A window to submit it, and then we'll queue those up later on today. So Alexis, I'll turn it back to you.
Okay, thank you so much. It's just my pleasure to introduce our next speaker, who is a developer, and her name is Annika Colston. She's from AC Power. She's the president and founder of AC Power. And AC Power is an impact development company, which specializes in repurposing contaminated land and other low-value land into revenue generating solar projects. So focus on solar. I know that we had a lot of questions about that, so we're really thankful that she could join us. So AC Power's mission is twofold. One, to overcome barriers to development, to bring as many solar projects to market as possible, while maximizing the benefits to the community that have been historically most impacted by the sites. So you can see why we wanted you all to hear from her. With a portfolio of over 24 projects in operation or under development, and a pipeline of more than 250 megawatts, AC Power is well positioned to be the market leader in solar development on contaminated sites. So we are very excited. Thank you, Annika, for joining us. Take it away.
Thank you so much, Alexis, and everybody at the EPA for inviting me to speak on one of my favorite subjects, the hard but rewarding work of developing solar on Superfund sites and, when appropriate, taking title and acquiring the underlying asset. So AC Power is currently developing several such projects, and I want to share some of those lessons learned. I'm going to use AC Power, or WE, to represent the collective group of all stakeholders that are involved in our projects. AC Power often acts as the facilitator, so we bring together the long-term owners of solar assets as well as the long-term owner of the Superfund site, and you know, we are the coordinator. So I'm first going to launch into an overview of solar development on a Superfund site. And I think this fits well with the top 10 questions. The first one being the location, location, location that Bill mentioned. And so when we're looking for a site, the first thing we look as the Superfund site identification, does it make a good candidate for a solar project? So separate of all of the distinguishing factors related to it being a Superfund site, we want to make sure that it's a good solar site. So does it have the interconnect, offtake, incentives, permitting, site conditions, and the other characteristics that are important and in and of themselves are difficult to, it's difficult to find good solar sites in general, let alone on Superfund sites. So when we accomplish that step, we move into looking at the Superfund site history. And so that was also mentioned by I believe, Bill. And, you know, one of the things that we like about Superfund sites is that they're well characterized. There's a lot of information that's available about these sites. And so we can go on to the EPA website and onto the Superfund website, find out who are the key EPA people that are involved in the project and you know, what is the background about of the site. And then we look to identify all of the stakeholders. And when you've identified all of the stakeholders, identify like three more. And I can't say this enough. It's probably the most important initial step to project development because there are more people that you think that are involved or curious or want to be involved in the site than you could ever imagine. And so start locally, very locally in the site, go to the town, go to the state, go to the EPA, even those that are involved for the solar project, to just build some relationships and start to feel out, are there any red flags? Does this make a good project? We've had several projects where we've just walked away at this point because it wasn't the right time. And so it may be in the future, but this development of stakeholders and partnerships is so important to the overall project. So the next phase is really the where we launch into kind of a dual process. We're looking at the solar project development and then separately, number five, looking at the Superfund site assessment. And so if we are looking especially to taking title, that number five is critical. And so the first step on step four, we are looking at the solar project development process, budget, timeline, economics. What's going to make this solar project work? And how long is that expected? What are the various milestones in the solar project development? Because we're going to want to match that up to our Superfund site timeline because these projects take a lot longer than is anticipated. And so then we can get to a go, no-go decision. Does this project make sense? Are the stakeholders engaged? What are the challenges that will need to be overcome? Do we have a path for overcoming them? Do we have some wiggle room for new challenges that are going to be discovered through the process? And assuming that we move forward, we go ahead with our solar development tasks, then executing various contract documents, which depend on each site. And I'm going to go into an example so I can talk about some of those. And then I can't see on my screen, but maybe somebody else can. I have number 9 is the closing, construction, and then the ongoing O&M. So that there's a lot there, but we're just kind of wrapping that up and focusing really on this pre-development tasks. So we can look at the next slide. Okay, so this is just a case study for one of several projects that we have under development. This is at the Global Landfill in Old Bridge, New Jersey. And I have a really simple helioscope photo, a screenshot desktop image of what the solar site could look like. And I really just put it there to zoom it out and show you that this landfill butts up against the Cheesequake State Park in New Jersey. That's to the south and, west and east. And then north of it, there are several housing communities that are living right there. And so we identified this site way back in 2017. I'm giving that as just an idea of how long these projects can take to develop. We actually started the solar development in probably 2019. So there was a lot of start and stop. Our initial intent was to develop up to 4-megawatt solar project on the plateau of the landfill cap. So just basically on the flat top of it. And so that was our step one. We looked into it. It looked like a great solar candidate site. We had interconnection nearby. The state of New Jersey is supportive of solar on landfills. So we thought it was a worth exploring more. So we moved into the site characterization. This was obviously a very lengthy process. I've put a couple of sentences here just to give an idea of the background of the site. It was a solid waste landfill for 20 years. In 1984, there was a significant slope failure. And during that investigation, they identified 63 buried drums, and the site was placed on the national priorities list. A group of potentially responsible parties were identified, and in 1991, a record of decision was issued. So there's, from 1984 to 1991, quite a bit of work happening with the EPA. And then remediation was completed in 2012. So again, that took another, 20 years. So when we went to the stakeholders process, this site does have a very active PRP group. And so we immediately had to develop a relationship with them. We reached out to the EPA and to the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. DEP is the lead coordinator for the site. So they've taken the lead with us, but we continue to work with the EPA. And then quite a lot of interaction with Old Bridge Township, which I can go into a little bit more detail. And then the New Jersey Board of Public Utilities as it related to the solar project. There also within the Old Bridge Township was the community. So in number 4, as we advanced on the solar track, we submitted for the New Jersey Community Solar Pilot Program year 2, and we were awarded a 2.8 megawatt project. So slightly smaller than we initially anticipated, but the economics were attractive, and all the assumptions that we had made in the previous 2 years held, and we decided to proceed. We retained outside legal counsel and put together a team of experts to help evaluate the site risks and liabilities to go through, the various steps that the EPA has talked about here. We identified long-term owners of both the solar project and the Superfund site. So we have completed the most of the development tasks. By the end of December, we expect to be to have the development tasks fully complete. And at that point, we will also be able to move forward with the acquisition of the Superfund site. We will be doing construction for most of 2023, or at least, you know, post winter. So kind of between March and November, that schedule is partly due to the interconnection requirements and driven by the local utility. Not that it takes necessarily a year to build a solar project, but in our supply chain and current market, that it's taking about 9 months. So I'll just highlight a couple of the overarching challenges that needed to be addressed at this site, because I don't think that this slide captures really how much effort has gone into it. And that effort is really by all parties, the PRP group, the township, all of the AC Power staff, consultants, engineers, legal counsel. It has been a large effort. One of the big issues was access to the site. We find access to be a recurring issue, like legal access, title, deeded access to these old sites comes up time and time again for us. So we believe that checking title is one of the most important things early on in the process, but we were able to resolve that access issue after several months and perseverance. And the second big issue that had to be overcome was property taxes. There were decades of property taxes on the books that had not been paid and were never going to be paid unless the site was redeveloped. And that is primarily due, that is 100% due to the fact that there was no active owner. So there was no clear title to the site. So whereas it had a PRP group, it has an active remedy, the Superfund site is being managed. There is nobody who is owning and responsible for the actual site. And so in order to develop a solar project and address the property taxes, there had to be a change of ownership and for somebody to step in and take title and ultimately become the owner of a site and the landlord to the solar facility. So the property taxes were addressed with Old Bridge Township, and a financial agreement and pilot agreement was developed so that future taxes could be paid at the site. So that's one of the many benefits that came about as the project. The last thing I'll note here is the relationship with the PRP group. That is, it just cannot be understated, because we are entering into a 25 to 35 year partnership. And we recognize that the most important consideration at the site is the remedy, and that we always want to ensure that the remedy is in place and being preserved, and that human health is at the forefront. So the solar project is there to complement the remedy. And I think developing that trust and those contracts takes a lot of time and effort. And, you know, we're grateful for their interest and willingness to develop those agreements and that relationship. So I will close out with just my last slide, which is my mantra of getting through this. And that is the CPCP, which is collaboration, patience, creativity, and perseverance. I think we have to repeat this to ourselves all the time. These are projects that take quite a bit of time, but they are so rewarding. And I loved hearing the statement, I think it was, you know, for every 1 acre that's reused, we are preserving 4.5 acres of greenfield space. That is why we do this, because these sites make excellent candidates for solar projects. They just require a lot of coordination and effort. So happy to answer any questions or follow up offline separately. But thank you again. Hope to work with many of you.
Thank you, Annika.
think I'm on. All right, great. Thank you so much. And thank you for doing that kind of breakdown of just the process and all the considerations and, you know, everything that goes into it. I think that was really helpful for everyone to have. I'm looking at the time and I'm wondering, Jean, if should we do our quick poll question or should we turn it over? I know we have a lot of questions.
Yeah, I know we do have a lot of questions. So I think we'll probably skip this one so we can get on to our next guest speaker.
That sounds good. Okay. And our next guest speaker, thanks, Jean, is Michael Goldstein. Michael Goldstein is another developer partner of EPA. He's a lawyer, actually. He's a managing shareholder of the Goldstein Environmental Law Firm. He's president of Goldstein Brownfields Foundation, president of Goldstein Brownfields Group, co-CEO of Goldstein Kite Environmental Redevelopment Partners, former chairman of the Miami-Dade County Brownfields Task Force, and a founder, charter member, and the first president and chairman of the Florida Brownfields Association. So he knows his brownfields. And he's an original member of the steering committee of the National Brownfields Coalition and chair of the Public Policy, Regulatory Incentives, and Regulatory Partnership Committee. So he was actually involved in the negotiation and enactment of Florida's Brownfields Redevelopment Act in 1997, and has designated over 120 brownfield areas throughout the state of Florida. In 2013, Michael was awarded the Brownfields Leadership Award at the National Brownfields Conference by EPA, by the National Association of Local Government Environmental Professionals for achievement in and commitment to public-private partnerships, and also the Chrysalis Award by the Florida Brownfields Association at its annual Brownfield Conference for outstanding efforts towards cleanup and redevelopment of brownfield properties, including educating, and another, you see, we're lucky to have him as a friend, as educating the public and elected officials about the brownfield program and providing volunteer assistance to Florida communities, advancing legislation that promotes brownfields. And then finally, in 2019, Michael was recognized by the Southeast Brownfields Conference by receiving the Environmental Justice Champion Award. So I know what Michael will share with us is a lot of experience, and also highlight some of the EPA resources and tools that might help folks along the way. So thank you, Michael.
Alexis, thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you for inviting me. I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to provide some insight into our particular experience and hope that it will inspire others on the call and watching after the fact to have the confidence in the Superfund redevelopment program and the people who manage the program that we have. My goal within a very brief window is to make the business case for Superfund redevelopment and discuss some of the concrete steps we are taking to execute. I wear two hats, as Alexis indicated. I've been an environmental lawyer for 30 years, doing environmental lawyer type stuff, almost exclusively in the contamination space and contaminated site cleanup space. But I'm also a principal of a redevelopment venture called Goldstein Kite Environmental, where we are doing the work of buying, remediating, and redeveloping brownfield sites and Superfund sites. And it's in this second capacity that I'll mostly be speaking of. As we get into my presentation, I want to focus first on the title, Superfund Redevelopment in 2022, a post-Superfund investment environment. And that title was selected for a very specific reason. As I think we all have heard over the last hour or so, EPA and its staff have essentially drained out most of the risk and the guesswork from Superfund redevelopment. And so for those who are looking to invest their resources and resources of third parties, whether it's debt or equity, there's a normalization here of what historically has been a pretty risky undertaking. And it's almost as if the Superfund element of Superfund redevelopment, it has fallen away. And what we're looking at and dealing with is a challenging redevelopment environment to be sure, but not one that is hands-off, not one that's disqualified simply by carrying the Superfund status. Let's go to the next slide, please. The mission of Goldstein Kite Environmental is to identify, acquire, and reposition environmentally contaminated real estate for beneficial reuse in order to take advantage of undervalued opportunities and deliver superior returns to investors and principals. This approach enhances and diversifies the portfolios of our partners while making socially responsible investments that restore the environment, protect public health, revitalize local communities, promote climate stewardship, and create equity for historically marginalized communities. This is the classic doing good while doing well model with a slightly higher degree of difficulty. Let's go to the next slide. But before you can do good and do well in a Superfund context, you have to convince investors that the undertaking is financially sound. And of the many things that EPA and its Superfund redevelopment staff have done exceedingly well, it's to mine the economic data. We heard a little about this early in the presentation that makes the business case for investing in Superfund sites. EPA has detailed economic analyses and reports at the national level and at the regional level in all of the EPA regions. This first slide that I have up provides just a brief window into, snapshot into, the national economic analytical summary that EPA has put together. And if you look at the right side of the screen, what becomes apparent is that beginning in 2011 and going all the way through 2021, the metrics get better every single year. More sites in reuse, more businesses on Superfund sites, annual sales on Superfund sites increasing from $10.6 billion 10 years ago to $65.8 billion. That's an incredible increase. And then we also see a similar increase in the number of jobs and the annual employment income. Let's go to the next slide, please. The next slide looks at the economic indicators on a regional basis. When we started our venture to acquire brownfield sites and Superfund sites and RCRA sites, we were looking initially at the EPA region 4 states. And so the analysis that EPA put together on a regional basis for the Southeast US resonated for us and resonated for our investors. And as you can see here from the pages I included in this slide, the indicators are absolutely incredible and demonstrate that investment in Superfund redevelopment is a sound investment that provides a very meaningful and predictable return on investment. So let's go to the next slide. We were able to take the metrics and the analysis that EPA generated nationally and regionally and go out to market to our investor group and to others who historically haven't invested with us, but were interested, and create a model that we feel will generate between $750 million to $1 billion in private sector funding for this type of redevelopment activity. You can see on the right side of the slide that we are looking to assemble a very broad portfolio of contaminated sites, 35% of which will be brownfield sites, 25% petroleum, 20% Superfund, and then 10% RCRA and 10% other, including coal-fired power plants that are closing down. Over the next 3 years, we intend to ramp up from looking at 100 impacted sites per quarter to put under contract to 150 sites per quarter in the third year, and then closing on 10 sites in the first year, ultimately closing in 20 sites on the third year. This model takes us out actually 7 years. We're modeling between 2 to 4 years from acquisition to reuse, and a projected internal rate of return to our investors of 25 to 30%. Let's go to the next slide, please. There are six essential building blocks that we use from Superfund's, from the Superfund redevelopment program, to vet any single opportunity and to give ourselves confidence and our investors confidence that any single investment will work out at the end of the day. We start with the guidance for preparing Superfund ready for reuse determinations. We then proceed through the prospective purchaser inquiry service. We rely heavily on those meetings. Those are the best consultants that you will never spend money on, from a planning perspective, an environmental technical perspective, a legal perspective, and a regulatory perspective. And once we get our arms around what's happening on the ground and where the site is headed from a regulatory and technical perspective, we then dive into the liability management tools that Matt and some of his colleagues spoke to earlier. The box in this slide on the right side of the screen is a snip from EPA's liability resources homepage. There are a number of resources that are available. I've checked three out of the five that we tend to rely on very heavily with respect to every single deal that we're looking at that has potential exposure to federal environmental liability: comfort status letters, prospective purchaser work agreements and prospective purchaser lessee work agreements, and then the bona fide prospective purchaser work agreement. Let's go to the next slide, please. And then the third, the fourth, fifth, and sixth building block to perfect our deal structure and ensure the integrity of our investors' money, we go through this revitalization handbook, which is our Bible. I say that as the CEO of a development company, as an environmental lawyer. We keep this very close to close at hand and close to our hearts, because it's the perfect checklist for running down exposure to federal environmental liability and then putting together viable and lasting environmental liability management strategies. There is what's called a look first approach to environmental enforcement liability policy that a lot of our sellers, I'll talk about that in a second, rely on heavily, which we in turn rely on in order to get into contract with our sellers. Sellers typically want to be able to put sites in their rearview mirrors once they close a deal. And in order to do that, they need to make sure that EPA is going to look to a buyer first and not back to the seller. And then finally, if all else fails, we rely heavily on environmental insurance. Let's go to the next slide. There's another element, a second dimension to our venture, and that is not just providing returns to our investors, but providing returns to the communities in which we work, which are heavily going to be, have been, and will continue to be environmental justice communities. We have an affiliation with a 501c3 entity called the Goldstein Brownfields Foundation. And our intention is to take a percentage of the profit from every investment we make through the fund, allocate that to the foundation, and then the foundation in turn will invest in the communities in which we're generating returns for our investors. And specifically, what we will be doing is we will be providing grants to not-for-profit groups focusing on environmental restoration, public health protection, climate stewardship, and affordable housing options. We'll be establishing scholarships for undergraduate and graduate students interested in the green economy. We will be providing startup capital and microloans to local businesses and not-for-profits. We'll be providing seed funding to conduct land use research, analysis, and community engagement. We're going to support workforce training. And we're also going to finance independent consultants and toxicologists for environmental justice stakeholders so they don't have to rely on what we're telling them. They'll have their own voice. Let's go to the next slide, please. This is a continuation of our very meaningful cultural and institutional investment in equity for community stakeholders and environmental justice communities. There are three resources in particular that EPA has created and disseminated in the Superfund space that speak to community engagement and environmental justice. We have absorbed the teachings of these resources, and we recommend them as well to those who are listening now and after the fact online. Let's go to the next slide. The previous slide spoke to or identified some of the guidance documents and planning resources that are available. They don't have the force of law. However, there are certain policies and liability management mechanisms that EPA has at its disposal that developers like GKE and others need to take advantage of in order to access federal liability protection, some of which, including the one I have here up on the screen, now incorporate a very specific community involvement component. And that's something that we're tracking and will be part of our Superfund initiative as we go into communities all across the country. The program that we are rolling out is not just a Region 4 program, which is where we started. We intend to be in every single region across the community, across the country, rather. Let's go to the next slide, please. A couple of quick case studies, two sites that we have under negotiation, very exciting, both in Region 4. This first site is a waterfront site. Part of it lends itself to a public park, which we hope to make happen. It's between 100 and 150 acres. This is a great canvas for multiple uses, a lot of creativity. In addition to the public park component, we think that there's solid infrastructure and strong market conditions for industrial, logistical, retail, and commercial uses. We intend to pursue all of it. The seller is a Fortune 500 company. They have a very sophisticated environmental and real estate team, which makes our job easy. They do have significant anxiety in disposition. They're requiring a significant demonstration of capacity. The key attributes of this site for us involves a ready for reuse determination in place, a really spectacular prospective purchaser inquiry meeting with EPA, strong RPM support, legal support, Superfund redevelopment program support, and Brownfields program support. And then this site also features what I call LTG remediation status, all lights turning green, which has happened to be getting into this site at the tail end of the cleanup. And it's very redevelopment friendly. There are significant opportunities here for safe deployment of investor capital and principal equity, financing, economic return to investors, sparking near offsite redevelopment, creating publicly available open space, access to waterfront and recreational amenities, including public health benefits. On the seller side, I mentioned this earlier, the key seller concern is not only whom they're dealing with, but ensuring that the buyer gets us, will get the first look from EPA if things go south. On our end, our key concern is the ability to access the state brownfield program's incentives, notwithstanding an eligibility exclusion in state law for Superfund sites. Unfortunately, right now in this particular state, there is no ability to tap into state incentives for Superfund sites. We're hoping to overcome that. One way we're doing that is through environmental insurance and other economic incentive programs like new market tax credits. I see that I'm a little over my time. I'm going to race through these last two slides very quickly. The second site under negotiation is another Superfund site in Region 4. We like it very much, not only because it's in a university setting, it gives us an opportunity to collaborate with university stakeholders, but it's proximate to an EJ community, and we're looking forward to investing in that community that has very strong leadership. And then finally, some lessons learned. Anika talked about this in her presentation. Patience and persistence, job number one. These are very complex transactions that take time and massive resources to come together. These projects are doable, but they're not for the faint of heart. The biggest lesson learned that we had a feeling would be the case going in because of our experience on the environmental legal side for 30 years, lean heavily on EPA and into the EPA resources. Staff is deeply qualified, intensely committed from the regional level to the headquarters and across programs, and they will bring to the table pre-existing ties and insight to the community that cannot be duplicated elsewhere. Also, the Superfund redevelopment program is already put into place. the building blocks. I mentioned six of them that we rely on that one will need to properly plan, design, engineer, and permit your reuse, and evaluate and develop financial models, fix and manage exposure to federal environmental liability, such as some of the ones that I mentioned and some others here on the slide. Make sure you understand and use them. Environmental insurance is a great best management practice for supplementing protection from environmental legal liability exposure. Keep in mind that sellers are demanding partners and will challenge you to demonstrate expertise, experience, capacity, and patience. Finally, with the right vision, ownership team, project team, financial model, and liability management plan, the market will react favorably, and equity and debt will be available, and there are plenty of opportunities and avenues to do good while you're doing well in the Superfund redevelopment context. Our model is not the only model, but we think it's a good model, and we're excited about continuing to partner with EPA and its staff and communities across the country. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you so much. I don't think I can have any words to express how helpful all that perspective is, and just breaking it down as well, and all your experiences. I will be really brief. I hope we can get in maybe one question, maybe not, Jean. But again, we'll put this link in the chat for everybody. First point of contact, as Michael said, you know, lean on us. We're here. This is our job. So feel free to reach out in your region and just get a conversation started with the Superfund redevelopment, the site team. All that information is available online. So go ahead and reach out. Do you want to go to the next slide, please? And in terms of staying in touch with us, we have a mailing list. That I think I see a link that was just sent to everyone. So please sign up for our mailing list. We won't send you too much, but we will make sure that you get invitations to future events like this, especially if we're going to be in person at some of the larger development-oriented conferences. We want you to know about it. We have resources that are really could be helpful to your work. We want to share those as well. And I will just thank everyone for the time. I don't know, Jean, if...
Sure. So we're going to try to get through what we can in the time that we have remaining. Okay. So I'll ask my speakers to go ahead to all come back on camera, because we may be shooting questions at you very rapidly here, depending on how much time we have. Mm-hmm. And for the live audience, if you can stay with us, I'll try to run just a few minutes past our scheduled end time of 2:30 to try to fit in a couple of more questions today. Mm-hmm. So this very first question is a pretty simple one, but I want to start with this one because it's such a core concept. Are you able to facilitate redevelopment before the remediation is complete? And I know we said earlier that was one of our poll questions, that you can build this into any point in the process, but they go on to ask, do you plan redevelopment around the need for future monitoring and characterization work that you might do at a Superfund site? Alexis, can you help direct that one?
Sure. I mean, I think probably I can answer it the shortest, because I've been doing this the shortest time. So in the interest of time, yeah, I think that that's part of it in terms of getting in there early and being able to kind of be aware of the remedy design and the decisions that are being made, and, you know, where it makes sense and where it's safe to be able to kind of contribute to that decision making. If anyone wants to add, please feel free.
I just spoke at length, but I'd like to jump in really quickly. I mentioned that the prospective purchaser inquiry meeting is the best and most talented set of consultants you'll never have to pay for. It's in that meeting specifically where you will sit down with EPA staff and deconstruct what you intend to build. And staff will literally walk you through the stormwater issues, the soil management issues, the remedy and integrity management issues, so that your redevelopment is integrated and aligned with the specifics of the ROD and how it's been implemented and how it will continue to be implemented going forward.
All right, excellent. We did have a comment for potential future topic about RCRA sites, and if there's going to be specific topics where you might focus, where we have OSRE, OSREDI, and OBLR put together a similar presentation, but just focus on RCRA sites. And Alexis, I don't know if that's something possibly in the works.
We'll pass that along to our RCRA colleagues. Yeah, thanks.
All right. Beautiful. All right. Our next question here, when using the prospective purchaser inquiry service, will the current property owner be aware of that inquiry? And are there any fees associated with using the service?
Casey, you look ready.
Sure. So first of all, no, it is completely free to everybody. And thank you to Michael again for plugging it. It's one of the most beneficial resources, I think, to prospective purchasers. And he's right. We are the experts on the site. We are wanting to share all the information and knowledge that we have. What was the first part of the question? I answered the second part first.
They wanted to know if the party would know about the inquiry.
Okay, so as you know, EPA is not typically the landowner. That really depends on the situation. So we do prospective purchaser inquiry calls that involve all parties, including the landowner. Sometimes we do them with just the prospective purchaser. Clearly, everybody has a little bit of a different agenda when they're thinking about purchasing a Superfund site and future use of a site. And so if everybody's more comfortable having those as separate calls, we're happy to do two different ones. So we can adjust that as needed to the site situation.
All right, excellent. How about this question about state programs? One of the attendees asks, can all or part of a Superfund site be developed when you're using a state reuse program? For example, the Pennsylvania, the PA Act 2 program. Does anybody know?
Well, I'll say typically most state voluntary cleanup programs, I'm assuming the Pennsylvania one that you mentioned, have usually, as Michael mentioned earlier, some states still have a restriction on the enrollment of quote unquote Superfund sites or NPL sites in a state voluntary cleanup program. So what we see more often, at least I'm in Texas and in our region six states, is their neighboring properties. You have a state enrolled in the property enrolled in the VCP program next door to a state Superfund, to a federal Superfund site. So we do work in collaboration with them. But it's not, at least in my experience, not very common for a property within a Superfund site to also be enrolled in a state voluntary cleanup program.
Okay. All right. Excellent. Our next question, if you can talk a little bit about windfall provisions, can you explain the windfall provisions that a local government who owns a Superfund site would be considering when they're selling parcels to get them back on their tax roll?
Yeah, I'll talk about that. The windfall provision applies with respect to when a bona fide prospective purchaser acquires a contaminated property. And the sort of the general overarching principle behind this is we don't want a situation where a party acquires a site and then EPA spends, you know, tremendous amount of money cleaning up the site, and that property owner turns around and sells the site and recoups a massive increase in market value in the property, you know, funded by the federal government. So we work with parties to try to head that off ahead of time with and we can certainly work with a local government in those instances to try to, you know, negotiate that lien. If there is indeed going to be a lien from a, you know, increase in fair market value that is, you know, greater than the looking at that in relation to the EPA's undercovered response costs at the site.
Okay. All right. Excellent. I think we'll squeeze in one more question or comment that came in. And for those of you who may have submitted your questions anonymously, I'll share these questions with our presenters to see if they can follow up with you. But if you sent the question in anonymously, we don't have any way to track back who you are. So if you did send a question in anonymously, but you would like a presenter to follow up with you, if you're willing to resend that question with your email address attached, we'll be happy to share that with our presenters. But let me pull in this one last question. This seems to be a theme about concern for PRPs who might do cleanup and what happens to them. And so this question asks, what type of program or protections are built into this program to protect PRPs who are not involved in the redevelopment, but are still actively involved in cleanup, for example, O&M or operation and maintenance at a site, so that their costs are not increased by the redevelopment effort?
Good question. Anybody want to take that? If not, we can follow up.
Well, I thought one of our presenters really nailed that, which was saying that they had such a ongoing cooperative agreement with the responsible party. So as I like to tell people, sometimes you don't want EPA in your business. And in that case, I think it's very important for a developer and or a prospective purchaser who has planned development or future use in mind to really, really be in close coordination with that responsible party. They know what their responsibilities are. That's clearly lined out in a legal agreement between them and EPA. And you want to make sure that you understand that as the developer. You understand what their legal agreement, what their legal responsibilities are to EPA and what their ongoing activities at the site will be as you are planning your future use and your future redevelopment at the site. That's definitely something to think about if there is a PRP at the site who does have long-term obligations. And a lot of times there can be a mutually beneficial relationship for both the prospective purchaser / developer user, future user of the site and the PRP group, but it definitely takes some close collaboration.
I can just add a little bit if helpful. We have different arrangements at different projects, but I think it does come to starting early to figure out what are the PRP group's concerns, what are their obligations, how much are they paying for O&M, what are those O&M requirements, and then to understand where there might be overlap. And ultimately, the PRP group is looking for some benefit to them through the redevelopment, and you know, at minimum surety that there isn't going to be any harm done to them, either economic or to their remedy. But we've found in most cases that there has been some economic benefit through us taking on some of the O&M that might be behind what we call behind the solar fence, or there might be, you know, some economic benefit that can be directed toward them through the, you know, solar project revenue, you know, as sort of like a quasi landlord. So there are ways to work together.
I'll just add that a developer coming on as a most likely a bona fide prospective purchaser has got a number of affirmative obligations at that property. They are coming in as an environmental steward, and some of those obligations include, you know, not mucking up the remedy that's in place. So they risk losing their protection if they were to undermine the integrity of the cleanup. And you know, that's one of the things that's so great about the prospective purchaser inquiry process, is that EPA can, you know, we can't guarantee compatibility between a redevelopment and the cleanup, but we can certainly have a pretty good idea. Like Bill's example, like, hey, relying on groundwater to water your nursery is, you know, it's not going to work. Like we can help. Our staff know these sites inside and out and can, you know, head off some pretty obvious incompatibilities. So there's a number of checks and balances in place to protect the PRPs.
I'd like to add that environmental insurance plays a role here, because as Matt pointed out and others have pointed out, developers coming in will have are naturally incentivized not to interfere with a remedy, because doing so will void the bona fide prospective purchaser defense and expose them to liability. But on occasion, redevelopment contractors will do something negligently, accidentally, unknowingly to exacerbate contamination. There are environmental insurance products that will cover that, which will not only provide coverage to the developer itself, but to other third parties named by the developer as additional insureds or additional named insureds, which can be PRP groups, participating members of PRP groups. For those who haven't worked with environmental insurance, naming those additional parties should not, and historically has not, increased the cost of coverage.
All right. I do think we are about 8 minutes past our end time, and I'm getting some smiles and some nods that I think everyone understands we may have to close out this Q&A segment. But again, one last call for those who may have sent in a question anonymously. If you want to resubmit it with your name or email address attached, we'll work to get a full list of the questions that came in to our organizers, and that might help influence future sessions. Speaking of future sessions, Alexis, I'll just remind everybody that in the chat, we did put a number of helpful links, one of which is how they can add their name to your mailing list for the Superfund Redevelopment Program, and they'll find out about webinars like this. So please be sure to add your name to that that mailing list. And I will pop on to do our closing reminders, unless, Alexis, you have any final thoughts you want to leave the audience with?
I don't. Just thank you to all of our presenters, and thanks for everyone for joining. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. All right. Well, then I'm going to take over here and call up our final reminders before we close things out. I do appreciate everybody staying on for just a few extra moments to do some additional Q&A time. I do want to invite you all to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network at cluin.org, and be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which goes out on the first of each month, which will also let you know about other free online training, websites, and technical resources related to hazardous waste site characterization and cleanup. Our next Tech Direct edition will go out on December 1st. For those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation material or a collection of related websites on our topic, we'll find them on the seminar homepage. So it's the same URL I highlighted at the start. Here we are at the end, and we're circling back. So that URL shown on this slide is where you went to register, it's where you went when checking in, and it's where I'll send you if you're looking for the materials. There are tabs along the middle of that page where you can access the webinar slides as well as related resources and URLs that were highlighted in the chat during our webinar today. So I encourage you to bookmark that and reference that page or point colleagues to it at any time. Now, if you stayed on the line, you can fill out that online feedback form. It is on the seminar homepage. If I sneak us back to that page, there's a tab that says feedback form. As long as you click that link and fill out the feedback form, making sure to check the box certifying you were here for the entire delivery, as soon as you submit your feedback, you'll have access to download or print out a participation certificate. Looks something like this one. If you don't check that box certifying you were here, you won't get a certificate. So please be sure that you follow that step. We will email a copy of the certificate to you as well, but those sometimes get blocked by junk or spam filter, so I encourage you to download it from the confirmation screen. And if you happen to host a viewing party at your location and had other colleagues joining you in a conference room, please send the link to that seminar feedback form to them, because they can fill it out on their own and get their own participation certificate, even if they didn't register to attend on their own. And for those of you lucky enough to be replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, and yes, the session was recorded, it will be archived and made available for on-demand playback. So if you're watching the recorded version, right around now in the recorded version above my head, there will be a button pointing to that seminar feedback form, which you can fill out. So you can still go to that seminar homepage or click the feedback form button above my head in the archive, fill out the online seminar feedback form based off your replay, and get a certificate for watching the recorded version. So with that, I want to thank all of our presenters and organizers who helped put together today's session, and the over 200 live attendees who joined us for the seminar. We hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time, and you'll join us on a future session. With that, I'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.